what is today, December 12th? December, today is December 13th, 2016. My name is Sam Edwards, and I'm here with
Jay Reichman.
Thank you, Jay. And today we're at Chroma Technology, and we'll be talking about his experience here as an employee owner and one of the founders, the culture of employee ownership, the structure, and the history. So Jay, to start off with, do you want to talk about what you were doing before even Omega? We can go back that far, or however you want to introduce yourself.
Okay. Well, I'll go back to college. That's sure. Best, maybe as far back, because I ended up working at Omega Optical pretty much right out of college, basically my first job out of college. And what led me, talk just briefly about what led me there. I went to Brown University and received a bachelor's in mechanical engineering there, although for most of my time there I was sort of doing kind of more of a physics track. But in addition to that, I was also interested in things like intentional communities, and I lived at a housing co-op, like Brown Association of Cooperative Housing, BAC for short, which had three sort of hippie co-op houses. So I was always kind of interested in cooperatives to be as sort of a side thing. Not that I thought that I was really going to sort of end up working in an environment that became sort of what Chroma became. But I did have a philosophical leaning towards cooperative work environments and cooperative living arrangements. I started Omega, working at Omega in 1983, autumn of 83. Basically, I was not looking for a job at Omega, but I was just looking for a job in the area. Decided I wanted to, try to make it through the winter and sort of start, live in Vermont, where a good friend of mine was already living, and if you go to Vermont in the autumn, it's hard to leave if you don't have anywhere else you have to go to. So basically, a friend of his was working at Omega and decided to stop by, and seemed like an interesting place and worth working at. It did have sort of almost like a co-op kind of hippie feel to it, which was sort of a attracted me, a lot of interesting people working there, whom you've met a few. And so the only my ticket in was that I had used the spectrophotometer before in science projects at school, so I was probably one of the only new employees to actually have ever done anything even remotely like what was done there, and had sort of a basic physics understanding of what they were doing. So the only position they had available was in the shipping department, so I started in the shipping department. Turned out to be probably the best place you could possibly start in a place like that, because there in the shipping department you got a chance to see everything that was made. You learn how to handle and clean the optics, because shipping involved also cleaning and packaging, labeling with a white fine point markers on the edges of filters, even measuring filters. So pretty quickly became probably the go-to person for doing a sort of unusual spectral measurements of optics. And after a year, sort of gotten into the production and went on from there, moving sort of more and more into production. But that was a good background way to introduce myself to the company. Really sort of knew just about everything that was going on there in terms of a product. Moving, fast-forwarding to the time when Chroma started, I actually was planning to take a leave of absence at about that time after working on a project that Omega was doing for the Hubble Space Telescope. Decided I sort of wanted to have a break and just sort of see where I was at in terms of things, what I wanted to do. So I actually stopped work at that time with, under good relations, basically, with Omega. Soon learned about what Paul and Dick were thinking of doing, and it sounded like, well, I wasn't doing anything else at that time. It seemed like didn't know I was coming back to Omega. It seemed like something that was worth giving a few years and helping them out while they started up. So when I got back from a long vacation that summer, started up in June, whatever. So basically, that's how I sort of got into Chroma at the time.
So I'm actually kind of interested about the work you did with the Hubble Space Telescope, because I've been hearing about it for months, and now we're finally here. I mean, just briefly, if you don't mind.
Omega got the contract. I don't know the details of how we landed the contract. David Marcus, who was at Omega, was probably the lead sort of project manager in terms of all the paperwork, and I was ended up being sort of the science and engineering manager, the design engineer and such, working with the engineers at JPL to sort of work out problems and sort of make sure that they got what they needed. It was for what they call the Wide Field Planetary Camera 2, which is the big color camera that does, which has sort of a whole filter set of individual filters. It has a monochrome CCD imager, and through the use of filters and sequential imaging, that those are combined to create the beautiful color images that you see, in the magazines and everything. The telescope had, I'm not sure of the sequence, but it was not the first camera. That was WIFPIC 1. It was the second camera, but it was destined for the first, for being installation in the first servicing mission. That servicing mission ended up becoming famous as the one that installed the corrective optics to deal with the terrible mistake that was done, where they perfectly polished the main mirror to a focus which was not the right focus. Although it was perfectly focused, it was the wrong focus. It was focal point. They ditched one of the four instruments that was in there to make room for the corrective optics. Fortunately, they didn't ditch the WIFPIC. All the images up to that another servicing mission that happened several years ago were through the cameras and the filters that we made, at least the visible ones in the visible.
Getting back on track to, I guess maybe talk about even the beginning of Chroma that you were part of, because from what I understand, it took about 6 months to develop maybe the first project or product anyhow. So do you want to talk about the first 6 months to a year with Chroma?
Yeah, well, I at Omega, I had done some work with some of the one of the technologies, coding technologies called electron beam evaporation technology, and that was used mostly for beam splitters and mirrors that are exposed coatings, that so they have to have sort of maybe some slightly more durability than other types of coatings. So I, led the effort to build our electron beam coating chamber. So it was a little bit different than some of the other sort of the what we call the soft coating chambers for the precision filters. VIM was probably led that sort of led the work in terms of designing the interior and everything for that. But I sort of my baby was system was unit one, which was called unit one, which was the electron beam system. So I did a lot of the dichroic beam splitter work, and also worked on designing fluorescent filter sets, doing design work for the soft coating. So did a bunch of things, but so sort of did a mix, like everyone there, we did a mix of things. I did a lot of customer, was the sort of application scientist for working with customers to help develop filter sets. Did some, a little bit of tutoring work where, did some of the stuff that Michael Stanley and others do now, as did a little bit of that in the early days. Designed, did a lot of work on the vacuum systems and the interior, the fixturing and everything.
So in addition to that, how did you feel about choosing to do an employee-owned company with Chroma in the beginning, particularly in line with your previous interest in cooperative living?
I thought it was just really intriguing to do it that way, and it definitely thought, like, given our unique situation of all being in it at about the same level with, no one coming in with major bucks to sort of start it. And there was this sense, certainly between Paul, Dick, Vim, and myself, and Frank, as far as the sales and technical skills, we all did realize that we had sort of our own, we each had sort of unique things to contribute, which were sort of all essential to the operation, to the mm-hmm. success of the company. So it made sense to have some sort of, the idea of employee owner, of that having it be an employee-owned company was very attractive to me. Initially, it was not 100% employee-owned, as you probably know by now. But we kept it mostly employee-owned up to the year 2000, which we sort of changed the structure to make it 100% employee-owned.
Actually, I haven't heard that yet. For the most part, I've heard that it was... I'm not sure if it was just an absence of information on whether or not it was wholly employee-owned before then or not.
It was never wholly employee-owned up until the year 2000 or 2001.
Who else had a stake in the ownership?
David Bradford, who was a local machinist, Bradford Machine, in Brattleboro, Vermont.
Right, okay.
I'm not sure how we developed the relationship. VIM, it was mostly through VIM, I would say. And we sold some shares to him, or we basically offered for him to buy some shares at basically par value, I believe, which is just $1 a share at the beginning, in return for doing a lot of going out of their way to help us, give us a lot of their time in terms of working on building the. Developing the machinery and the fixturing and some of the, so in return for that, he got, I don't remember how many mm-hmm. hundreds or thousands of shares. He was, graciously, voluntarily sold his shares in 2000 for book value at the time. So he made out pretty well. I don't know, as far as whether, but we have an ongoing relationship with Bradford Machines. We're still a very good customer of theirs. So, you know, I think overall it was a good deal for both companies.
No, I mean, as you spoke about that, it did jog my memory. I remember Vim talking about it, but I guess between him and the other founders who have talked about it, never stated it in a way that said Chroma wasn't 100% employee-owned before then. It was just that, yeah, he helped us, you know, fund making the machines we needed in the beginning because we couldn't pay for them outright at the time.
No, I mean, I could go look at the stock records if you want. I mean, you could go ask someone to look at the stock ownership history and see how many shares he owned up to year 2000. Now, we did not distribute anymore. He was not part of the, the stock bonus program or policy that we were sort of following over the first few years, where every year we were, you know the details. You know, we did it. We created our kind of our own system to maintain sort of flexibility at the expense, maybe not exactly the most best way of doing things in terms of taxes and stuff. But we just distributed shares every year to all the employees who were eligible for them. Bradford was not, being not an employee, was not part of that. Mm-hmm. So the shares that he received, that was all he received at the beginning. But it was a good chunk compared to a lot of employees that were getting shares annually, sort of incrementally.
Mm-hmm. So going back to the first decade, you talked about the kind of work you did in the beginning of Chroma. What do you remember about the development of Chroma as you guys grew through the 90s, and what that looked like and felt like as the company expanded throughout the cotton mill?
I pretty much stuck to my specialties, which was designing filters, working with customers to help them figure out what was the best solution for them. So I think I was an important part of the strategy, of Chroma's strategy, which was to provide solutions to the customers and do whatever we could for a reasonable price to get customers what they needed for them to be able to do their work and see what they wanted to see. Mm-hmm. So it to me, the physical filter itself was part of the package of what we sold. You know, ultimately we are selling information, or the ability to for a researcher or any kind of any scientist to make good measurements, get the data that they need, see what they want to see. Basically, that's what we really are selling in what we do. So our strategy has fallen in line with that. We put many hours through the applications scientists and other salespeople, talking to customers, basically helping troubleshoot their problems, figure out, a lot of times they think it might be a filter that's wrong, and they'll work it out and find that it's not the filter, it's something else in the system. So that's all part of I think what Chroma sells, offers as a service to customers.
Was there anything that you remember in Chroma's development, specifically as an employee owner, that kind of marked a significant shift for you in how the company was running, or how the size was affecting the company through the 90s?
You're getting it. This is... this could be off the record. I'll be mumbling here a lot, so you'll have to, hopefully you can edit some of this.
I mean, if one example sticks out,
we all eventually had to sort of specialize in what we do, and decisions at various levels had to be made. We had a, initially we had company meetings for weekly, in a weekly basis, discussing major issues. But ultimately, even though there were sometimes votes on various things, a lot of behind the scenes, just day-to-day decisions, and some big ones, really were done by individuals. Paul. There was always the at Chroma this sort of balance between the idea of employee ownership and people all being owners and having sort of like a being able to have input into major decision-making processes. But then there are the individual personalities, and Paul Millman was probably the biggest individual personality. But I've always recognized Paul also, along with Dick, as being the true founder of Chroma. I think he's actually been very gracious in allowing us to call ourselves co-founders. I mean, really, it was Paul's and Dick's initial brainchild, sort of like to go, having been fired or having resigned, to sort of start up that project. Now, Vim might have a different view as far as it, but certainly from my perspective, it was not my intention when I left to leave Omega and start Chroma. Mm-hmm. I think that the discussions of Chroma had started before I had left Omega. So I knew that was in the works, and on the side, outside of work, I was starting to help Chroma sort of like start plan and everything.
Did you work with Dick when he was putting together plans for Chroma?
Yes, I don't know the exact timeline. As far as what work I did before actually leaving Omega to go on my leave of absence, but by the time I went on my leave of absence, I pretty much knew that I was going to be at Chroma and was probably not going to come back to Omega.
Okay. Mm. So, do you want to talk about how you experienced Chroma expanding through the cotton mill and what that was like, particularly with adding more people to the kind of work that you did or the kind of work groups that you were in? Maybe even difficulties with the kind of town meetings you guys were having at the time.
Well, it's been a while, so it really has been. I think an interesting, example of. Well, I'm just trying to think of the timelines. When we moved from the cotton mill to here. Was that 2005?
2003.
Okay, right. So before moving to Imtech Lane. A lot of my time was devoted, apart from the, day-to-day just working, doing my thing at Chroma, was dealing with the lawsuit. There was a whole big period there, sort of chunk of time where the lawsuit with Omega was like a big part of my energy was devoted to. Although apart from that, I did sort of take some of my ideas of, I was always interested in sort of like thinking of what was the most equitable way of dividing the profits and looking things in terms of fairness. So I think I did have a lot of input into the structure of some of the ownership systems, the share. I was the secretary for many years, so I helped out in that regard in terms of like keeping track of all the stock purchases and everything going on. So I probably knew almost better than anyone else as far as like the mechanics of the process. I was also very much involved. I would say that the chain, the other big thing, which sort of showed a lot of what was going on at Chroma, was the decision to try to move to a 100% employee-owned company. Up to that point, like I said, there was there was nothing in the articles of association of the company, no real sort of legal restriction to the ownership of shares. There was no restriction as far as like selling the shares back to the company once people left. There was this point in 2000 when it appeared that the original co-founders were no longer going to be the majority shareholders of the company. And although I didn't find it a huge, and I didn't find that in itself sort of like a truly important thing, a total game changer. There were other co-founders that really felt threatened by that and wanted to sort of put something more into stone, basically, a structure that where they felt maybe more in control by virtue of there being more rules and restrictions on the way stock was bought and sold and distributed in the company. I think that's how the restructuring arose. All those discussions, that was sort of a very crazy period of time. It also happened right about the time when we did not know what was going on with the lawsuit. We had, I'm not sure the timeline, but we had had favorable judgment from the trial court. But then it was appealed, and it was in the Supreme Court appeals level at the time when we were doing the restructuring. So there was still sort of like this sort of shadow over whether the company, what actual value of the company might have been. So it was a crazy time that time, despite having meetings with lots of people involved, I mean, we had these major meetings. You might find there are cassette tapes, I think, somewhere of the meetings over the restructuring committee. Some of the people originally involved in that restructuring committee ended up being some of the dissenters where our second big legal issue arose out of that.
I wanted to go off the... Yeah, I'll go through here and edit anything that's discontinuous. no, that's very interesting. I had not heard, I guess, I feel like maybe in the recollections of the other founders of the litigation on record, for the most part, it's just like, oh, we had those two lawsuits in the 90s. Remember those? And they just moved on, which is fine, because I think at least with the first lawsuit from Bob Johnson and Omega, that one's all on record. And even Paul was like, yeah, you can just go pull up the congressional record and look at it or whatever. And I think I probably have. But
the dissenters suit is on record somewhere, too. Yeah, yeah. I mean, we eventually settled that, but that was very, that was very difficult because it was against, it was about money and about, it wasn't about like sort of like the the essence of chroma and the livelihood. It was like dealing with, you know, shares and feeling like, you know, the dissenters, you know, were asking for way more of a chunk of what we thought, you know, the company than the founders themselves felt like they might even get out of the company. You know, so it was really, you know, kind of nasty.
So that restructuring then of how the shares were distributed in the early 2000s, that was because of the second lawsuit then, right? That's what you're saying.
It was the second lawsuit was a result of the restructuring.
Oh, okay. So,
the shareholders of Chroma voted to amend the Articles of Association to restrict the ownership rights of shareholders. That led to an opening where shareholders who did not agree with the changes could formally dissent and ask to have their shares, sell their shares back at fair value. Fair value, quote unquote, fair value became the heart of the lawsuit and trial, and we went to trial over it. Eventually settling out of court, but trying to determine fair value for Chroma shares, that was like the heart of the issue. And there's a huge disparity between what the dissenters were claiming fair value was and what we thought fair value was.
Well, naturally, if they're trying to get money out and dissent at the same time.
Right.
I'm not saying I would do that to you guys, but if I was in their situation,
right.
Like...
Right. But we really had to really think hard about, you know, how we valued the company. And it's still an issue today. You know, the structure of the company is still based on this notion of, since we don't really know what fair market value is, because it's such an unusual company, and it would be so expensive to convert right at this point to fair market value, that we still use book value as the valuation of the shares, but we have sort of a mechanism that in the event that the company does go on the market and does realize market value, that the difference between what the company actually gets sold for and what book value had been, that difference gets distributed equitably among both the current shareholders and ex-shareholders. So when one leaves the company, you actually get a trade your Class A shares for these Class B shares, which are have value in the event of a sale of the company.
Okay.
So that's sort of the heart of what we came up with to deal with this, you know, issue of how does one value the shares of the company.
All right. So we kind of dug into the aspects of that lawsuit a little bit.
Right. Well, the lawsuit wasn't about that. It was about, you know, what the shareholders who dissented from that change and wanted to have their shares, sell their shares back, what to pay, you know, what the value was of their shares, and what they wanted was as close to fair market value, and determining fair market value was, you know, which was, could have been many, many, many times more than book value. That was the issue.
So to get that timeline correct, the company was going through a restructuring.
That was in 2000. So the end of 2000, like December something, 2000 was when we voted the change in the Articles Association. And in addition, we also amended the bylaws to sort of match it, and actually created like a true sort of a board of directors through the bylaws with sort of a more strict structure to the board of directors at the same time.
So out of that restructuring process is where the lawsuit came from, because they want, as yes. you've been saying, they wanted the market value of their shares.
Right.
Okay.
I honestly don't know why they dissented from it, honestly, but.
It happened the way it did either way.
I don't want to get into sort of like personal details of the main dissenter, but you know, he did a lot of things for his own benefit. You know, as it turns out, so he was like the financial controller at the time. I'm not saying that he extorted anything, but. You know, there were policies that we enacted which ended up benefiting him very well down the line. So
it seems fishy. We like in a company that is supposed to be, you know, more cooperative or democratic, and then one guy's apparently been moving things to, you know, benefit himself.
Nothing illegal. I minthe example was, you know, he advocated for this very generous long-term disability policy, and then he, you know, went on long-term disability, and you know, we think that he knew of his own situation and sort of helped get as sweet a deal for himself as he possibly could.
I think Paul's giving me essentially the same story. Okay. So moving forward, kind of want to talk about what it was like moving up here into, you know, the Bells Falls facility a little bit later after that. So that was about 2003, 2004. Yeah. And anything you remember around that?
That's. I think I was trying to get to this whole time, but in terms of how things really worked at Chroma, you know, this is an example where we had, you know, the idea of having sort of like the shareholders, and like we had, I can't remember, we decided to try to have a one person, one vote, vote as to where to move to or to move, but basically, it was like we could move anywhere we want as long as it was where Paul wanted us to move to. I mean, that's basically how it ended up being structured. I mean, we were going to stay in Vermont, even if the majority of people already lived in New Hampshire and were fine moving to Keene, New Hampshire, which was the other kind of like option. Staying in Vermont and, you know, moving up to Bellows Falls, which at the time for most of us was like, you know, the boondocks. I mean, you know, a lot of us were more focused on Brattleboro at the time. But it was staying in Vermont. And that was very important for Paul for political, for his own political reasons. And, you know, again, I'm not saying it was a bad idea. I mean, maintaining our image as being a Vermont company for him was very important, and strategically, from a business standpoint, it might have been a really good idea, and it might still be a really good idea to present ourselves as not just an employee-owned company, 100% employee-owned company, but also a Vermont company. To the rest, there are a lot of research to the rest of the world. Maybe that does seem attractive, you know, small town. I don't know, Vermont, it's sort of like, you know, Vermont cheese or something like that. Maybe it has sort of like this homegrown, you know, cachet to it or something. And, you know, and I'm not the salesperson, I'm not into marketing, and it might be great, but I'm not sure he totally convinced everybody to agree to that. It was more like, you know, this is important to him, and, you know, he's, and certainly at the time, you know, certainly we do not want, you know, it's everybody's intention for Paul to not leave Chroma in a bad, you know, an antagonistic relationship when Paul leaves Chroma. You know, he could wreak, you know, I'm not saying it's best for everyone for him, when he does leave, for it to be in a very amicable way. So, so if there were some times when Paul really kind of put his foot down, you know, it's either my way or the highway, and sticking with his way, the highway, was not a good way to go for the health of the company. So it's one of those things where Chrome was doing really well, you know, staying in Vermont might be part of that. But I'm not sure that was sort of a company-wide decision. Now, I don't remember the specifics of the vote that sort of ended up sort of getting us to Vermont or to this spot, but there was more than one vote, I think, involved, I believe. So,
yeah, I think from, you know, between the document that Paul has given me and some other things I've looked at, it looks like there was originally a one person, one vote, clearly vote. But because of the, I guess in Paul's term, in the document he gave me, and depending on how this conversation goes, I'll be editing more things out of this at times. He phrased it to say not explicitly who, but said an employee owner, which means that he doesn't have to disclose which employee owner or if they're a founder or non-founder. But he said that an employee owner had identified that 5 of 6 of the founders had voted to stay in Vermont. So then the second vote was one share, one vote, because the founders otherwise had majority at the time, or close enough to staying in Vermont was the decision. I'm not sure if that rings any bells.
It does, but don't source it from me. I mean, I don't know the details. I think I would say that sounds right, but only because I've heard that told to me before. So, I can't sort of like vouch for that history. It might be true. I can't vouch for it.
Who knows? Maybe my historical document will also do some of this rewriting.
Yeah, I mean, there are, somewhere, we probably do have, notes. Can I take this for a second?
All right, do you remember where we were?
We're talking about this moving to Imtech Lane,
yeah,
and what the history was there. I was going to say there are probably some minutes to meetings somewhere that sort of have some sort of documentation of that. I'm not sure where they are.
Yeah, were I in grad school doing this, I would access those as soon as possible and dig through them, but do not have the time or the skills to do that.
I'm not sure it's worth it, yeah.
Neither do I. So, moving on, I mean, now you clearly chose to come here to Bells Falls in Vermont, to stay in Vermont. So looking through, the early 2000s, and, I guess we can even kind of bring us up to now in 2016, what were some other developments that you saw in the company that kind of stick out in your memory? In size, difficulty with, getting too big and how to make decisions, the kind of the development of the structure and the governance.
I think this most recent change on paper anyway of management structure is going to be a bit, hopefully it's a big deal. I hope we're not just hiring people, to get salaries. Hopefully things are happening. but it is, you know, I understand it's going to be, I know it's going to be a slow process. I think the challenge is going to be for the board of directors to remain in the loop enough as a board of directors to really sort of stay on top of the wealth of what's going on in the company, and in order to be, you know, truly do their job advocating for the shareholders.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of one of the big challenges with the way it's currently structured. We're not only an employee-owned company, but we're employee-only board of directors. And it doesn't have to be that way. There's nothing in the articles of association, for example, that specify that. It's something that we could change at any time. And there has been discussion about trying to open up the board of directors to, like, outside directors. Who knows, maybe that's sort of a possible change that could sort of change things. But right now it's hard. It's hard sort of keeping track of all the hats that one wears.
Yeah.
and being able to separate responsibilities. It's hard to sort of say where Chrome is at right now, because we're all so busy just trying to get stuff out, which I guess is a good thing. We do need to sort of make sure we're working towards, I'm not sure the ownership model is going to work too much longer. So, step back on that. Right now, there are aspects of the current ownership model which I think are troublesome and make it difficult for the current founders that are still here to leave, especially Paul.
Mm-hmm.
I think the hardest part about it is, for me, is that the true value of the company can only be realized, since it only can be realized if the company's sold. There sort of is this sort of inherent instability to it, which means that the company has to be sold at some time for it to really sort of like come, you know, for the value of the company to be realized. And that's hard for us who are getting older, and the mechanisms in place I don't think are solid enough for us to really feel totally comfortable leaving Chroma at this time without feeling like we might, our, you know, what we think is our fair share in the equity of the company, being maintained. Mm. I think Paul is, you know, and others, you know, we've been, I think we do need to sort of get on and bite the bullet and work on seeing if we can work through the ESOP structure system and see if we can make that work for us. It's not an easy thing, because the fair market value for an ESOP is the way a company's valued is tightly regulated by the ESOP rules. And there could be a huge discrepancy between ESOP version of fair market value and what the company really is worth on the market. I mean, as you know, technology companies, it's very hard to judge how much a technology company is really worth if it were actually you know, being sold. Mm-hmm. So I think the founders, current co-founders, don't want to shortchange themselves or miss out on that. So on the other hand, you know, I don't think we want to feel like we have to sell the company before we leave. That would be, at least for me, you know, I really do believe in the employee ownership model and would like to sort of make it work and be sustainable. I'm not sure that ultimately the current structure really is sustainable over a long period of time. Mm-hmm. But I hate the word sustainable, but viable, workable.
Yeah,
sustainability, it's overused, but...
Exactly. Yeah, no, I appreciate you talking to me so clearly about those issues and the you and the other co-founders transitioning out, because I've heard a little bit about that, but, you know, it would be interesting to see. I understand that turning the company into an ESOP would be very expensive, and it wouldn't be easy because of how highly regulated it is.
Yeah, I've never been really good with business and finance and stuff, so... Despite having read 10 times over how the ESOP functions, I still can't count myself as sort of an expert on it. But we would have to figure out how to pay the current shareholders at the fair market value, which is going to be, since it is going to be a lot more than book value, there has to be a way, the company has to come up with it's sort of a weird process where we'd be selling it to ourselves in essence, but for just a very different price. So we have to pay ourselves, figure out some way to pay ourselves without going broke doing it. So it would take time. I mean, it can be structured. It might be difficult doing it at the same time that we're expanding the building, just from a cash flow perspective. Banks have been pretty generous to us. I'm not sure there's a bank out there that'd be willing to finance, the sale of the company to an ESOP. But I think we do have to keep on working towards that.
Okay. Want to shift gears a little bit, because we're here now like 52, 53 minutes. I'm not sure when you have to go, nor do I know what time it is.
I really sort of have to go in 10 minutes.
That's perfect. Yeah, we can finish in 10 minutes. So we've talked a lot about the technical details of both the lawsuits and the ESOP and what the ownership models look like. Do you want to talk a little bit about how you've experienced or seen like the culture of employee ownership develop and function in this company?
Well, I think it's really a mixed bag. There's the obvious upside of the model that we have right now, which is more than just the employee ownership. It's also the ultra fair, more than living wage, that we provide. Mm-hmm. The upside is that people, there are lots of people here who are doing really well, better than and are really grateful for, really know that what a good thing it is to be working at Chroma, and I think they, show that by caring about Chroma and being, good sort of corporate citizens in a way, and sort of staying involved and helping out with the culture, with things having to do with the culture of the company, the cultural affairs. There are a lot of people that do a lot of volunteering to help get, parties, organize annual parties, Christmas parties, do a lot of these sort of fundraising things. Like you saw the Secret Santa thing, which is just amazing. When you see have all the presents that our people give. So that's really good. On the other hand, the downside is there can be employees that are in a situation where they don't want to be here, but they can't afford to leave, and that's not a good, that's not a good situation. So that's sort of the downside of the of it. And there's the question about whether it's really, we're going to be able to, keep on making enough money to pay for the wage scale that we do. It does concern me the pace of change, technological change, our ability to automate. It seems like we're just dragging a little bit and not getting stuff done to implement more some important automated process automation in largely the area of test and measurement and quality control. I think that's going to be important. I mean, Paul mentioned this at a recent company meeting. Is I think we have to learn how to stop, expand our productivity without hiring more people. I mean, we don't want to automate, and we're not going to. I don't think anyone wants to lay people off because we sort of got a machine to do what they were doing, but we want them to be able to expand, allow them to do other things that need to be done, and so expand our productivity and our work without actually hiring more people to do the rote work that's really hard to do, and it's difficult work to begin with, and I wouldn't want to be doing it. There are a lot of jobs here that I'm glad I'm not doing. So I think that's probably the biggest technical and business challenge that we have. I mean, now that there is this senior management now has there is a group of people that now can kind of do more openly what they've been doing before. This is gets back a little bit to a point about this idea of there being a lot of sort of group decision making, but when it comes down to it, the individual strategy, individual decisions are made based on what individuals, are doing, decide to do. There are, Paul, for example, has, has been trying to move Chroma more towards getting into the larger volume market, which, there are several of us, like Vim maybe, I don't know where Vim is at, but who always love the small shop culture where we did smaller numbers of really difficult, interesting things, to do lots of one thing, for these prices where there are these diminishing returns, you make a lot of them, but they get cost less, and it becomes more important how you sort of like do whether the cogs work out, cost of goods, and whether you can sort of trim the cost of production to a point where you can sell it cheaply, and you could, with a high volume, you could either make a lot of money or lose a lot of money based on just the minor tweak or miscalculation of what it really takes to costs to make something. So he's pushing us more in that realm, and that had never really, I felt, been a conscious strategy decision that everyone agreed to at the board level. But Paul's had been pushing us towards that, moving towards that. Now I think he can more overtly do that without, by virtue of being the CEO. And I'm okay with that, actually. At least it's open now. that shift worries me in terms of the ultimate culture of the company, but I do recognize the basic idea that for a company to be viable, they have to be growing. You know, the idea when a company is not growing, it is actually dying. You know, that's sort of one of the natures of capitalist society. You know, maybe it has to do with the fact that, you know, I don't want to get into the philosophical, but I think I do understand that aspect of economic activity, that you have to be expanding in order to stay, you know, in order to stay, that is the steady state. The better steady state model is to be growing.
Cool. Well, thank you very much.
It has to do with the fact that the population is increasing, you know. I mean, you have keeping up with the expansion of human life on the planet, which drives a lot of what we do. I mean, it's not just the population, but it's the introduction of more advanced medical technology and to the third world, China. I do applaud Paul for having the foresight to create, you know, more global presence, having actual offices in some of these countries, because that really is where the growth in the market is coming from now. At least it was up until January 20th. That's where it's been. Honestly, China is a big question mark. I mean, I don't like the direction politically that China is going. That could all fall apart by virtue of China and not the U.S., but, you know, for now it's been, you know, it's a really good idea. And it's good for the people of China, you know. I mean, it's good for, I think having more advanced technology and more better medical technology, clinical tech, you know, capacity is good. So We'll see if it can all hold up.
Well, thank you very much, Jay.
All right.